Welcome back to Offworld, the show where we talk about all things space exploration and pop culture. Today we are talking about the 1983 film The Right Stuff, based off of the book. I'm Ariel Waldman.
And I'm Norm Chan. I'm so excited for this interview you did because The Right Stuff is, it's kind of almost like a documentary style movie about the Mercury era.
Absolutely. And that's why our guests are just really awesome to have. We have TESS's very own Adam Savage and astronaut Jim Newman. And Jim has been involved in multiple spacewalks and done like a lot of incredible stuff in space. I mean, going to space at all is pretty incredible in and of itself. But Jim really is a gem.
And Adam, of course, is a huge space fan and nut and loves the Mercury era, has a spacesuit from that era, replica of a spacesuit from that era. So let's take a listen to your conversation.
Today, I'm joined by Dr. Jim Newman, a NASA astronaut who has been on 4 space shuttle missions, 6 spacewalks, and was formerly the director of the NASA Human Spaceflight Program in Russia. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So, The Right Stuff, it came out in 1983. It was based on a book. It's very, going over the history of human spaceflight and how it got started and the framing of going from aviation into human spaceflight. Like, what did you think of the movie? What did you like?
Well, I watched it, of course, many, many years ago. Then I watched it again recently. And it was really a treat. I really enjoy the movie. It's factually quite accurate.
Oh, okay. I'm curious about, what you were, often when I watch a movie I haven't seen in 20 or 30 years, I'm surprised by what I remember wrong. Was there stuff that you were inspired by the first time and you watch it the second time and you're like, oh, that didn't quite work out, or something that was very different?
Well, what it was talking about, of course, is the right stuff, this ethos, this idea mm-hmm. that the people going into space have something different.
Right.
And I wouldn't say that that's not completely true, but it's not. People going to space are just like you and me, only more so.
Right.
That's the way I would put it. But what really struck me in watching it again, and this time with my wife, was the dichotomy, I think, of where we were then and where we are now, which I am glad is a very, very different place.
But specifically, what do you mean? In terms of the politics of the country or the technology that NASA had to launch people into?
Particularly the technology and particularly access to space. Right. I was fortunate to fly during the shuttle era when we were able to get a lot of humans into space. And of course, we made a great deal of progress, because if you look at those people who are in that movie, I would say they're not representative of our country writ large. How do you think about that?
I mean, to me, what I really loved watching it, being a millennial and I didn't grow up during this era, but watching what people went through, the thing that excited me is that it was actually reflective a lot of the experimental nature of human spaceflight that we still see today. So watching, them with the experimental airplanes and how those work was very reminiscent of Virgin Galactic. And, they've got the White Knight 2, which carries the spaceship 2. And it's the same sort of configuration that you saw Chuck Yeager in with the X-1 airplane. And so to me, that was the really cool bit of getting the feeling that we're still continuing on this experimentation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, I mean, did Mercury, I know we're all a bit young for none of us were adults during the Mercury era, but did Mercury, influence either of you a lot as you've sort of grown up with the knowledge of what those guys went through?
I'm old enough to predate Mercury. And so I would say that what affected me the most was watching the country go to the moon, was that I realized that in a youthful way, it looked like, we're really making progress. We have an opportunity here, I think, to improve, right? We'll go to the moon, we'll live there. I'll admit I've been idealistic too long in my life and naive perhaps as well. But I guess it was actually when we spent 3 years in Moscow that I really came to realize that people haven't changed much in the last few thousand years.
So, I mean, that was another one of my questions is, how has astronaut training itself changed since the 1960s? You in the movie, you see them going through all of these really over-the-top sort of tests of, you know, they're sticking needles in their hands, they're going through all these psychological tests. You know, how has training changed at all since the 1960s?
That was one of the things I remembered from the first time I watched the movie was the hand. Mm-hmm. They stuck the needle in it.
Oh my God, I hate it.
Scott Glenn sitting there.
Yeah. And, and so
Did you have to do that?
No.
Oh, good.
Of course not. It turns out that your basic human is probably, your basic healthy human, is well equipped to go into space.
So it's not, so, I mean, the right stuff gives the idea that they're looking for the cream of the crop, the top one-nth of a percentile of humans that can take all of the stress and this trauma, and you're saying that NASA's built it into something where your average, more like your average human could do it safely?
Absolutely. At that time, there were so many unknowns
right. That
that was probably the right thing to do, was to look for the right stuff, because you didn't know what would be happening. The Soviets certainly were not sharing what they learned. Right. They ended up with a very different outlook. Korolev was their chief designer, and they decided very early on that their cosmonauts would not have the, shall we say, the importance in their program that ours ended up having.
Oh, so the cosmonaut wasn't as central as the astronauts were.
Correct, particularly in asserting themselves, as we saw in the movie so vividly, asserting themselves as a force to be reckoned with, as not just spam in a can, not just a monkey pushing buttons. And I think that that's really an important point, because that's one of the things our country does, is we honor the individual and the contribution. And the pilots at that time, test pilots in particular, were, I think, in many ways uniquely qualified for that role, because I'll express it as a civilian who, although I flew small planes, nonetheless, I certainly was not a jet jockey. Mm-hmm. But what I was able to do was through a process, and this is taking civilians and getting us ready for spaceflight, is through a process of, okay, sure, we crawled, we walk, we run, we ride bikes, we drive cars, we fly some kind of airplane. Okay, and then we get to NASA, and we go to a T-38 jet, and then we finally get the ultimate in performance, a space shuttle. And it's this process of working our way up, which the military has already done. And so they're already ready. So that part of the team is well qualified. And early on, when they didn't know what sort of people would function well in space, I think that they were doing the best they could. We have, one quick story.
Yeah.
We have a saying, and that is that amongst the astronauts, and that is, you leave half your brains on the launch pad. It is such a dramatic moment.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. It is truly dramatic. A launch.
Even though you're entirely trained for every little thing, it's still sort of like mind-boggling.
Absolutely. And in particular, the first time. Now, I'll grant you, after you've done it a few times.
But that's what I was going to ask. On the fourth time, you're like, oh, you're kind of chill about it, or is it still remarkable?
Might as well be chill. Do you remember the movie Bridge of Spies?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I love his quote in there when he was asked why he wasn't concerned or upset about the prospect of being executed for spying, and he asked a simple question: would it help?
Right.
And that's sort of the way it is when you're on the launch pad. You've already decided to roll the dice again, and the most sensible thing to do is to chill, to do what Gordo did. Catch a few Z's if you can. Now, that's easier for me to say.
Sure.
As a mission specialist, I picked the mid-deck for my final launch to Hubble.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilot and the commander and the flight engineer, they were all up on the flight deck.
Oh, you're in the, right, okay. So,
yeah,
you're
so
in the
they were expected to be alert and
right. Working
hard. And, you know,
like,
I was
I
along
this.
For the ride. You know,
you're like,
I was,
I'll have some caffeinated apple pie now.
Yeah, and it's great to have somebody drive you to work in the morning.
Yeah.
That's the way I felt about it. Okay.
That's amazing. I mean, so one question I had was, you know, you talk about being, you know, spam in a can, and you see in the movie the astronauts are really wrangling with the engineers about getting a window, getting controls, and they're really trying to, I mean, work with the engineers, to put it nicely, to get their demands into the spacecraft. Do astronauts have much interaction with engineers anymore, the people who are actually designing, you know, space shuttle or the next generation of things?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
No, you're right on. This is a key point, I think. in the evolution of technology, right? And that is, there's the person who makes it and the person who uses it. And without the user interaction, a maker will sometimes flub. They'll build things that a user can't really use. And so this really highlights, I think, as technology gets increasingly sophisticated, how important, right, a good user interface is, for example. And having people aboard, and what I like to think about with people is not only being part of the process, but what do they bring to the product? And in the case of spaceflight, what people bring is a different operational capability than just computers to date. Mm-hmm. Now, with AI and machine learning, we'll see, but for now, a person performs in a different bit, if I may, phase space, right? A computer works a particular phase space. You can land an airplane in 0-0, and a pilot cannot do that.
Right.
But a person operates in a different phase space. The computer had no idea what to do, for example, when all the hydraulics went out, and the only thing they had was the rack that came down on that airplane, and the pilots figured out how to steer the airplane in real time,
right.
as you recall, right. using the throttles. They operate in a different part of phase space. So in order to get the best performance out of the man, the human, machine combination, we really, well, need both.
I was lucky enough to visit the neutral buoyancy lab last spring, and I watched them suiting up two astronauts, one in a standard EMU suit, but another in the new Z2 mm-hmm. suit with mm-hmm. The rear entry. Mm-hmm. And the level of communication between the astronauts and the engineers was constant.
Right.
How does this feel? Where is this? Oh, does this need to be a little shorter? Next time, well, and it's a constant. I've gotten to also look through some of NASA's archives at some of the prototype suit parts. And the thing that always amazes me about everything is it's clear that just people built this. This isn't mass produced. Right. And does that follow all the way through the organization? Just that sort of, we can fix this for each of these people because it needs to be customized?
Well, actually, in the space shuttle era, we particularly tried to move away from customization.
Right.
Because of the increased cost. And so I, for example, got to wear Sonny Carter's gloves, mm-hmm. for example, after whom the Neutral Buoyancy Laboratory is named.
Ah.
He was on that airplane with Senator Tower that,
right.
That had an unfortunate landing, and he passed away. But the point was is that you didn't necessarily get your own gloves anymore.
Right, right.
You didn't necessarily get your own customized. Now, occasionally that would be necessary.
I've heard that Mike Massimino's hands are so large, his are the largest glove molds there are.
I flew with Mike on Hubble.
Okay.
and absolutely, there are always going to be some times when you have to do that. But the more we can get to standardized sizes, then bring the cost down. Mm-hmm. Because in my opinion, again, I was fortunate to fly in the shuttle era just by luck of when I was born, and when we got to get a lot of humans into space. The whole idea is we have an evolution. We start off with people doing something that's never been done before, and you do need, perhaps, people who are willing to be more risk-tolerant, more capable under stress, and as we saw in The Right Stuff, it's still possible for there to be the potential for errors, even by people who are so well-trained. It's such a new environment. The fireflies out the window, for example, might have been distracting.
Is NASA now looking for a very specific and different psychological profile of an astronaut than they... Obviously, they didn't know what to look for back then. So, I've heard some famous stories behind the scenes of some early astronauts not getting along with each other. Not that that's required to work productively. But I just wonder, has NASA's requirements for the psychological profile of astronauts changed over the years?
I believe so. Very much so. In fact, I would say the Russians were onto this earlier than we were.
Really?
The psychological aspect of it. And America is catching up in that regard, and I think has made great strides. I think that one of the indications to me was when, because I've got some great stories from early on in the selection process, which perhaps we'll have a moment to share, but in particular, for the Hubble flight that I went on with Mike and John mm-hmm. and Rick, we got to go on a NOLS, National Outdoor Leadership School, expedition tailored for NASA, where they talked about the difference between working as a single person, single seat fighter jock, for example, or part of a team, for example. So it was, how can you get along on an expedition as opposed to where the outcome of the group depends upon every individual working together. And that in particular is important for longer duration missions. So as we all, think we're interested in expanding our presence in our solar system to start, and then perhaps further, we need to think less about the one person doing something fantastic and more about a group of people, whether it's the moon or Mars in particular, or on the space station right now, working together.
Yeah, so one of the scenes I wanted to ask about was, so there's a funny scene in the movie, Alan Shepard, before his first flight, he's on the launch pad, he's ready to go, and they keep getting delayed, and he ends up urinating in his spacesuit because they didn't, really design for him to go to the bathroom because it was going to be a suborbital flight and quick and everything. So he urinates in his spacesuit, and so pretty much America's first man in space goes into space just covered in urine. And, I know you've come across, funny stories that you've heard or that you've experienced, and I wanted to ask, have you encountered in any of your space flights funny or unexpected scenarios, that sort of, are of that sort of that line of, hilarity?
Well, in order to make sure that doesn't happen as a problem for people, they offer diapers now.
Yes.
That's what Chris told me that. He said they don't wear the UCD anymore.
No. It's all depends, the adult size.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Now, that's, in my opinion, that is for the prudent astronaut. It's more like a parachute. You don't use it if you don't have to.
Yeah. Right.
And the whole idea is in order to end up dry in orbit when I got there, I'd light load on the fluids in the morning.
So no big Diet Coke before you leave.
No big Diet Coke. No 4 cups of coffee, okay?
Yeah, sure. Sort of thing,
as they mentioned in the movie. But so let's see from a just unexpected point of view. Well, let me share just a quick one about Mike real quick. And that is, so it's my 4th flight and Mike Massimino's 1st flight. And I can remember distinctly when we got into orbit and everybody were first up there. And Hubble's higher than the space station.
Oh,
it's a good bit higher. So you actually see a lot more of the Earth in one fell swoop. And he looked out the back window, and he looked at the Earth, and he said, "It's a planet." And for the first time on all of my flights, I felt like, if you remember Star Trek, Scotty saying, or whoever it was who said, "Captain, arriving planet side."
Right.
As you come in,
right.
And so that was the first time I really had that real feeling, and Mike helped me feel it. Having a new guy along was really a treat.
Yeah.
Because he was seeing it through his fresh eyes.
Amazing.
Yeah, totally amazing. I think, one of the stories that you had told me that I always now tell other people is, if you go to space, go longer than 4 days, and
absolutely.
I don't know if you want to tell why that is, but
It's predominantly the fluid shift. What's really astonishing is how easily the human body does adapt to space. And about 4 days, first of all, the first day you immediately have the fluid shift of all the blood that we store in our legs. We have 70% of our blood volume below our heart.
Right.
Four-legged creatures have 70% above their heart.
Huh.
So we have all this extra blood down here, which when you get to zero gravity, of course, it floats up and then redistributes, and you end up kind of with a puffy face. All the wrinkles go away for a few days. It's kind of nice, okay? But then the baroreceptors in your neck say, "Oh, too much blood volume." So you end up, through diuresis, you end up down about a quart. Huh. But it takes that, so your stuffy feeling, your taste is a little off. Spicy foods taste a little better than normal because you can taste them. But then after 4 or 5 days, you end up really getting the first plateau, shall we say. And then there's another one after about 9 days. And then the people who've been up there longer say, at 30 days, there's another one at 30. And then the people who've been up there longer, 30, yeah. But at 6 months or a year, is when you really feel comfortable. But I found for myself after, the first 5 or 6, 7 days, you really felt 95-98% normal. It's like, how is it possible for a human which has evolved on the Earth to feel so comfortable in this very foreign environment?
Yeah.
It's truly amazing.
Absolutely. So I guess my final question that actually I want to ask both of you is, what is your hope, your personal hope for the future generation of astronauts? We watched this movie about the right stuff and the early days and what they thought they needed then. What's your personal hope for what the future generations of astronauts are going to be like?
Well, I strongly feel, and I think, I hope many of us do, is that what we want is for, well, my mother went to Antarctica at the age of 78.
Wow.
Okay. That's she awesome. Saved up and you know, paid the money and went on the trip.
You are a family of explorers, clearly.
Exactly. But I think we're a world of explorers. I think that if people know that they can save up, work hard, save up, and go to space for more than 4 days, then I think people will do it. So my hope for the future, for low Earth orbit in particular, is that it'll be accessible to everybody who, like a round the world trip now, if you work hard, you save up your money, that anybody will get to go. Someday the moon, right? We've got to do that.
Yeah.
As John Young said, single planet species don't survive. And so we've got to have the moon, we've got to have Mars in part of our portfolio, and we've got to keep going. That's what I hope.
I, for one, hope to be one of the early civilian ambassadors to space, as I'm sure you do too.
Yeah, I'll be right there with you.
Good. Absolutely. Thank you so much for talking to us, Jim.
Well, what a pleasure.
Yeah, really thanks so much for coming.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
So that was an awesome conversation. I absolutely adore listening to astronaut stories and also getting sort of a comparative summary of what the space shuttle era was like with the Mercury astronaut era. Jim Newman has a ton of great stories. I actually had the great chance of interviewing him for my book, What's It Like in Space? So a lot of his stories about what it's like in space and kind of the funny, weird things he encountered are in this book, so you should definitely check it out. Thanks so much for joining, and we'll see you next time.